Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Wildfires, the tragedy in Maui. Wildfires, the repeated tragedy in California and across the American West, especially the drought these many years. But climate change is profound. And we are also in the season of El Nino, which is drier and hotter summers for Australia and a drier, hotter environment for all of the planet. All this adds up to wildfires increasing, and I welcome a professor who helps me understand what can be done about the wildfires. Reversing climate change is profound but long-term. Right now, we have settlements across the West, in Australia, across the Mediterranean basin that are extremely at risk. I welcome Professor Hussam Mahmoud. He is here to help me understand how it is we can prepare not just our forests, where the forest management is brilliant, but also our settlements, where people live. Hussam is a professor in infrastructure in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, Colorado State University, Fort Collins, Colorado. Professor, a very good evening to you. Your essay in Nature magazine attracted me immediately because you've been thinking and planning and writing about these circumstances for some time. If I understand correctly, there are natural landscapes where we see all of the firefighting, the backfiring, and there are things you can do for natural landscapes quite different from what you can do for a building environment where people live. First of all, the natural landscapes. Are you disappointed that there's not more preparation of those forests with controlled burns, with pruning the vegetation? There's often that complaint. Have you seen that around the world? Good evening to you, Professor.
John, thank you so much for the kind invitation to be on your show and for the kind introduction. Sure, fuel management is in the wildland, I should say, has been an issue that has been brought up for a while now, actually, and not just in the U.S., but it's actually across the world. We've seen major fires in Europe, in North Africa, Australia, and a lot of the discussion has evolved around in many ways. And I would, you know, we can talk about that later about management of fuel. And so this is one of the elements. This is not the only element that controls wildfire risk.
In Maui, there is talk. The investigation is underway, and I mention it because it's such a tragedy. We're talking about a have to deal with the fact that the electric companies that bring us power are also a grave risk to all of us. But I saw reporting about the kinds of vegetation that people permit around power lines. Is that something that you are studying as well? There are some things that dry out and turn into tinderboxes more than others.
I agree. I mean, there are a few places that are studying the ignition problem and ignition of different type of vegetations, the influence of moisture content in the vegetation, sometimes even in the soil, on the potential for ignition for different type of vegetation or plants and so on. For Maui, this obviously, I mean, for Maui and for the campfire, this was an issue, of course, and the power lines. The fact that our infrastructure in general has obviously been deteriorating for quite some time, it poses an issue when it comes to ignition. And you probably know that in many cases, ignitions are human-based.
Yes.
But in other cases, you know, in other cases, it's not. About 60% of fires in Canada are actually not caused by humans. So the fact that, you know, these power lines will cause an issue in these previous events, I wouldn't say that by solving this, you know, power line problems that we will have the problem solved either. There are many factors that need to come together. Ignition is one of them. Ignition from the power lines is one of them. But there are other sources of ignition that we have to understand. And then the element that is critical is once it ignites, what can we do about it to actually make sure it doesn't propagate and destroy communities?
Yes, now we turn to the parts of this story that are most gripping to me because it had not come to me as an amateur to look to divide the landscape into two parts. there is the natural landscape, and we've touched upon it. What is to be done about the fuel that builds up, the undergrowth, the vegetation following, say, heavy rains? That's a story that they often have in Australia, where the wildfire season is coming now, and where the eucalyptus trees are like torches. But here in North America, the fuel builds up if it's not removed. However, then we come to the what I regard the revelation of your story, which is the building environment. Can that be better prepared? How do you define the building environment? All human settlements, all buildings? Well, how do you divide it up, Professor?
So that's a great question. And, you know, for us who kind of work in the research environmental academia, we understand the importance of being able to model or predict how the fire will make its way inside communities. For a while, John, there has been an effort by different researchers everywhere in modeling fire propagation inside communities. So to your point, one of the issues that they ran into is that the assumption that has been made that the wild land and the built environment are somewhat similar, and therefore models that we use for predicting propagation of the fire in the wild land can be used in communities did not actually hold the truth, didn't work. So when people try to use the same models and say, I can predict what happens in communities using wildland models, well, it didn't work. So we recognized that there's a tremendous difference, but also recognize that we need to develop a tool that while it gives us that distinction between the built environment and the wildland, it still allows us to connect to them. And here's why. Some communities, you find vegetations inside the communities, what we call intermixed communities, where there's tons of vegetation. It's almost like the homes are inside the forest or wildland. Other communities, you'll have the built environment or the beginning or the edge of the communities interfaced with the wildland. So these are two different kind of settings in a way. But at the end of the day, I need to understand how the fire will propagate from the wildland inside the community. And if I have any vegetation inside the community, can I capture the interaction between a vegetation and another vegetation, as well as a house and another vegetation, and vice versa? So being able to capture that interaction is very critical, because this is sort of envisioned, you can envision the whole problem as a network. We know that we need better models for the wildland, but we cannot, or for the built environment, but we cannot separate them in the way we analyze things. It's like disease transmission. I cannot just look at one single person or a few people and forget the rest of the community if I want to understand the likelihood of the disease spreading everywhere in my community. So we developed a new model that allows us to understand how fire propagates inside the community, but that model also takes information on the wild land, the likelihood of embers flying and landing on your community, the likelihood of the fire transmitting between one building to a vegetation and vice versa, or between two buildings or two vegetations, in a network setting, so that we can start to understand how we can tinker with this network to reduce the likelihood of fire spreading in the community as a whole.
You published with your colleagues, integrated graph measures reveal survival likelihood for buildings in wildfire events. You published this most recently, and I understood what I could reading the abstract. We're talking about individual communities being assessed with a model that you're developing as to what buildings are going to burn faster and how you can defend yourselves. I'm stating this pedantically because it's what I understand, Professor. And these models, are they ready to be applied to real communities? Are you satisfied with them?
Yeah. So, yes, thanks for bringing this paper up. I published with Akshat Shulukhwat, and Akshat is my partner. He was my graduate student and now is a postdoctoral researcher with me at Colorado State University. We've used the model, as you probably saw in the paper, on the glass fire and the campfire.
Yes.
After that, we applied the model to the Marshall fire, and we had really good predictions so far. We've gotten really, really good predictability in terms of being able to tell how many buildings and where will be damaged. And we've gotten, I believe, if I remember, 86% for the campfire. We got glass fire was about 64%, and we did the Marshall fire, and we have about 74%. We wanted to see if we can actually also predict what happened in Maui. We haven't published this work yet, and so we ran the model on Lahaina, and we got very good predictability again. So the very promising thing now that we know that the model is working, it's telling us and giving us really good predictions of which home might survive or burn in a wildfire event. Now we can back work the problem, reverse engineer it in a way, to figure out which homes should be hardened and which vegetations should be removed so that we can lower the risk for the entire community.
I'm speaking with Hussam Mahmoud. He is helpful to me. She has a piece in Nature magazine right now that is profound because it lets us understand when a fire hits a community, how it can defend itself in anticipation of such an event. Hussam is a professor of infrastructure at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, Colorado State University. And when we come back, what can you do for your community now? What can you do for your home now to prepare for the worst case? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.